Welcome. Today on Catholic Messenger Conversations, Bishop Thomas Zinkula shares his thoughts on the life of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, who died December 31st, 2022, nearly a decade after his historic resignation as Pope. Bishop Zinkula presided at a diocesan mass for the late Pontiff Emeritus on January 4th at Sacred Heart Cathedral. So just wanted to give a little bit of that background as we get into this conversation. So I'm just wondering, how do you think the background, the formative years, and the time and the place in which Pope Emeritus Benedict grew up, how did that shape his theology and papacy?
Okay, so, well, what was his background? You know, what happened during his formative years? And he grew up in a small Bavarian town in Germany, right? Mm-hmm. Which is just across the border from Austria, and particularly Salzburg was right there. He was a huge fan of Salzburg's native son, Mozart. As you recall, liked to play the piano for, you know,
Benedict, yep.
Remember? That was kind of for
relaxation
and whatever. He was the youngest of three children in a lower middle class household. I thought it's interesting that I don't know if I knew this or I'd forgotten it, but after he died, there's all this stuff about him. His parents' names were Joseph and Mary.
Oh, wow.
Joseph was a policeman, and Mary was a homemaker, and she also, like, sometimes would cook different places. So, he was really shaped by the Nazism, right? He was six years old when Hitler came to power. He's 18 years old when World War II ended in 1945. So that definitely shaped his youth.
Yeah.
His family did not embrace Nazism. I mean, he had to be part of the youth deal, but just because you had to. So having said all that, I have no idea how that shaped, you know, his theology and papacy. I mean,
yeah.
I suppose it did, but I don't know. I don't know. I comes to reflecting on it. All I know is that he was one of the most talented Catholic minds of his generation, and so all that stuff flowed into that. He served as a theological expert during the Second Vatican Council. It's like 35 or 36.
I mean, that's just amazing.
So I don't know. All of that somehow kind of sorted itself out in that manner that he was.
Well, I wonder, because I read something about how fond he was of his family, his parents, and his siblings, And it sounds like the family was pretty religious, so.
Yeah, definitely they were. And he was, you know, his brother was a priest as well.
Oh, that's right.
He was very close to him. I hear a lot about his sister, but I don't know, maybe I just wasn't paying attention.
So that just fascinated me, because I just wonder all of that heavy stuff.
I mean, you know, a lot of times people, when they, you know, the seminaries and monasteries and everything filled up after the Second World War.
So that helped
people to recognize the role, importance of faith in their, you know, just going through that whole hell.
Yes.
And so maybe with him, he wasn't in combat or anything, but that could have, coming from a very observant family. And then this whole thing with just that what he experienced in Nazi Germany, that might have drew him deeper into the faith.
Well, I wondered, because I thought about Pope John Paul II, who came from a sort of similar, at least he was in that era.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just wondered how that shaped them. And they had a very close relationship, too. And I wondered if it was all that kind of background that really shaped who they.
It's got to make a difference. I mean, why did seminaries fill up? Why did monasteries fill up? Why did, there's like, there aren't any, what is it about?
Faith was this thing you had to lean onto.
Yeah, right? there's like in foxholes, what's that saying?
There are no atheists in foxholes,
right?
Somehow
it can, when things are falling apart, then you kind of grab onto something that's more solid. That probably, you know, maybe magnified his faith for him.
I was just curious about that, what your thoughts were. So in your homily for the Mass, which I thought was really, really, really great, you said that Pope Emeritus Benedict gave himself to the Church pastorally, intellectually, and spiritually. What are some examples of his self-gift to the Church?
Right. So since it was Christmas, I was tying that to the Christmas characters, right? So for pastorally, the shepherds, you know, pastoring the sheep and all that. He was shy and soft-spoken. Everybody says that about him. He was kind. He was gentle. He's compassionate and hospitable. People talk about him being a model of grace and humility. You know, when he was elected pope, he described himself as a simple, humble laborer in the vineyard of the Lord. That's like when I talk about myself. So I'm just this you know, farm kid, right? You know, this Catholic farm kid from Iowa. You know, and so you know, as a pope, he demonstrated that he had a pastor's heart and a grandfatherly gentleness. You know, that was kind of his persona. And I used to hear about God's Rottweiler, you know, and he was in the CDF, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and because he had to crack down on things. And so probably most people had a sense of him as being this hard-nosed guy. Well, I've talked to priests and bishops who knew him, worked with him in Rome, and they, during that time, they would say, he's not like that at all. He's this, all these other kinds of things, adjectives I used. So that's kind of like, that was just something that was a role he had to play, you know, at that time, and he thought he did anyway. And so there's a pastoral thing in terms of intellectually, I mean, everybody talks about his astute intelligence. He's a superb, brilliant theologian. You know, but there's that pastoral piece too. You know, he always, as a teacher, he always sought to speak the truth with love. Love, he wrote and talked about love a lot, that in terms of his relationship with God, and God's a God of love. And that was very sincere and authentic. That was kind of the heart of kind of who he was and his faith. And, you know, he talks about love seeking understanding. You know, so that's sort of theology sometimes described as faith seeking understanding.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the intellectual thing, faith. But he talked about love seeking understanding. So as a theologian, he's trying to kind of explain the faith, and from that perspective, and he says, you know, so love seeks understanding. It wishes to know even better the one whom it loves. It seeks his face. So you know. With regard to that side of him, in terms of...
And love being Christ.
Love being God, Christ. Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. In terms of that, what he gave to the church, his self-gift to the church, one, his kind of classical book early on was Introduction to Christianity, published in 1968. It was one of the... That was one of the best people, you know, it's one of the best single-volume accounts of our faith. You know, it's kind of... A meditation on faith.
Write that down. Tell me what was that?
Introduction to Christianity. It's a meditation on faith that reaches into the depths of the human experience. Wow. So that was definitely, that's a significant book for him. Then there are three encyclicals, and then the three books on the life of Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, that towards the end, that was a big thing for him to kind of pull his thinking together in those books.
I forgot. Did he write those as pope, or did he write those?
I think he was pope, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think so.
And I'm wondering, did they work into his encyclicals then?
Probably.
Yeah.
And then for spiritually, giving himself to the church spiritually, he always had deep, deep love for sacred liturgy. It was his source and summit. It was the beginning and the end of everything that he did. He sought... through his teaching and his scholarship, his writing, to educate people how to read and understand the scripture, and he continuously announced the enduring presence of Christ's love in the Eucharistic mystery.
Wow.
So that's kind of, that says a lot about him, the man and the scholar and, you know, and priest, pastor.
That makes me interested in going back and reading some more of his books and some of his, rereading some of the encyclicals and letters. The right. one on charity is really good. I think
people would say, if you had to, okay, all these gifts, that was his best gift, I think, was his scholarship, his Catholic mind and his intellect and his writing. You know, he could express that so beautifully.
Wow. That's very, very good. So you also said that we witness his humility in a striking way when he resigned as Pope. How so? Why? What do you think it took for him to decide to resign? He was the first Pope to choose to do that in 600 years.
It took a lot of courage and humility. I think people recognize that then. They recognize it now as well. Think about it. He's the Pope, right? And he's... Mm-hmm. He's got all this power, and there's prestige, and there's history of guys not retiring and mm-hmm. just dying and with their boots on, and expectation of that. Mm-hmm. So to resign in that kind of retire right. In that setting that's a huge, huge thing. I mean, I think. You know, you might want to look at it as, interestingly, what might be considered Pope Benedict's greatest moment of public weakness, you know, admitting in February of 2013 that he was no longer physically capable of governing the church. Like, you know, that's saying something. You could also say that was his greatest moment of strength, that he could, you know.
I suppose you could.
You could look at it that way. I mean, he said someone else could meet the demands of this ministry, his ministry better than he. So what a powerful witness to his character and discipleship, to his deep humility and to his profound respect for the importance of the Petrine office.
But it wasn't just physical; it was mental too, wasn't it? I mean, he was going through a lot in terms of he was getting a lot of flack worldwide for some of his stances.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, mental, but I think he himself would say that he wasn't a great administrator.
Right.
He said that more than once, even when they were electing him. He's like, I'm not a good administrator, and I think he realized that he just wasn't able to. You know, it just wasn't his gift. It wasn't his charisma.
But a Pope doesn't need to be an administrator, does he? He needs to be a leader, right?
Leaders are administrate things,
okay.
Administer things. I mean, you know, yeah, you're running the Vatican.
You've got people helping leadership you do that.
Yeah, but you're overseeing it all.
Right.
Well, then you have to put it into practice, right?
Right.
You get this vision, and then it wasn't his gift. I mean, he said that himself.
Yes.
You guys sure? You don't want me to do this thing? And, you know, I mean, I think he twice asked Pope John Paul if he could leave the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith and just go back to, like, writing and things.
Oh, yeah.
I mean— He did it. God bless him. He's a son of the church. And it wasn't like he was a failure by any means.
No, no.
But it's just like, this is somebody else can do this better. I mean, that's a huge thing to acknowledge.
That is a huge thing. That's humility.
Yeah.
That's,
I would say.
Wow. He projected that. So, okay, during the papacy of his predecessor, St. John Paul II, then Cardinal Ratzinger served as head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith. You served as a priest and then as a judicial vicar during that time, I think. What were your impressions of his leadership in that Vatican office?
Well, I mean, he was hard-nosed. I mean,
yeah.
He was for sure. I mean, I'd go back a little bit because people portray him, he's this conservative, you know, and so some people weren't happy when he mm-hmm. was chosen to be Pope because, you know, he's, you know, like some people aren't happy with Francis because they think he's a progressive, and
right.
Those language is—it's not used well, I don't think, because he was, I mean, he was a progressive with the Second Vatican Council.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was He was one of a prominent group of young progressive theologians who sought to bring Catholicism into the modern era, and there were people pushing back big time on that. Mm-hmm. So that's where he was at, and then you know, after the council, then people, you know, he was concerned about progressives who were kind of hijacking it. You know, they wanted to move beyond the council documents and compromise the integrity of Catholicism. So other people, you know, they talk about the spirit of the council and everything, but that then they could just run with that wherever they wanted to, right?
Okay.
So then he became more, you know, oh, he didn't. I was going to say he became more conservative, but he didn't. Interestingly, you know, in his own judgment, his views never changed.
Okay.
These other things changing around him, you know. So the liberal of the council became the conservative of the post-conciliar years, but like I said, even though in his own judgment, his views never changed. He was, you know, in terms
so
of.
So he thought maybe there was too much experimentation.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. There was. I mean, there were, for some people, they were taking it and running with it. And he's a prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And he wanted to clarify the church's doctrine. And that was his job. That's what John Paul wanted him to do, you know. And they were of one mind, I think, in terms of what their concerns were out there. So he investigated, restricted, and censored the scholarship and writings of a number of theologians,
yes,
right? And he robustly defended the Catholic teaching and tradition. So he was like liberation theology in Latin America, sexual morality, some of those kinds of things, you know. He wanted to kind of clamp down on those things.
Do you think he clamped down too hard? Do you think that was fair in some cases to have censured some of the... one of the people, he Thomas Rees was the editor of America Magazine, for example, and he was ousted.
Yeah, right.
As a result of...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, some of those people were rehabilitated later, right? I mean, you look back and liberation theology, okay, there were Marxist parts of that, but there were other parts of it that were very in keeping with, and now it's mm-hmm. kind of been rehabilitated, you know, not the Marxist parts of it, but so there's, you look back and, you know, you could question some of the calls that he made or how he went about things, but I don't know what, you know, it's interesting, like he's, it's just so, to kind of pinpoint him as one certain kind of a person isn't fair. He was known as not only God's Rottweiler, but Dr. No at the Congregation.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? Dr. No.
Yeah.
So he was very, and he was very conservative with regard to the internal life of the church with its policies and doctrines and things. He was conservative on issues related to sexual ethics, gender, abortion. He called the church to a stronger sense of traditional Catholic identity in an increasingly secular age. So there was that.
Right.
But then when he became pope and he left that office where he had to crack down on things, you know, in the congregation, and then he was referred to as Father Yes. He was Dr. No, and then Father Yes, he had this thing, I don't know if this is his term or somebody else's term, but he ran with it, affirmative orthodoxy. He wanted to, present the Catholic teaching in the most positive way possible. That's what he was trying to do as Pope.
Mm-hmm.
And he emphasized the Catholic yes rather than what was perceived to be the Catholicism as a list of no's, prohibitions. He saw that was what was going on out there, and he wanted to present Catholicism as a positive option. So there's, and then in terms of, okay, you know, really conservative, well, with respect to public policy issues, he was very liberal. I mean, you know, like for example,
that's right,
he had no problem with universal health care.
Uh-huh.
He critiqued free market economics. He described both communism and capitalism as failed ideologies. Now, some people that want to portray him as a conservative, they try to ignore that or explain that away somehow. He strongly opposed both Iraqi wars.
So very, very clearly.
He was very strong in defending the poor. He's the first pope to talk about the environment. You know, John Paul didn't talk about that
they
much.
They called him the Green...
The Green Pope, oh, right. And yeah. he installed solar panels on, you know, roof at the Vatican. So, I mean...
So we were all trying to peg him in a political sort of
people
way.
People kind of... Yeah, yeah, right. We do that all the time.
And he wasn't. He was... He really...
He was more complicated than... Nuanced than people give him credit for, I think.
Well, so I'm wondering, you talked about how he tried to make the faith clear to people... particularly when he served as Pope. In what ways did he give attention to the synthesis of faith and reason, and why was that so important?
Yeah, so he definitely emphasized the essential relationship between the two. In fact, I was a little late to this podcast because I was talking to somebody and I was getting into faith and reason, and it made me think of Pope Benedict. And I'm like, oh my God, I got to go to this podcast. So... Let me just give you some quotes from him. Let them speak for himself. He says he said or wrote somewhere at some point, the God in whom we believe is a God of reason, a reason to be sure which is not a kind of cold mathematics of the universe, but is one with love and with goodness. Again, there he goes back to love. You know, so it's like. You know, they can go together. It's not one has to be this, you know, this right. cold sort of calculated kind of mathematical thing, but there's can be love and reason and goodness in that. He said, so there's secularism and fundamentalism. You can see those as two different things. Secularism maybe is more running with reason and discounting faith, and fundamentalism. Kind of really all over faith and, and you know and discounting reason. So he says both of those two, secularism and fundamentalism, exclude the possibility of fruitful dialogue and effective cooperation between reason and religious faith. Reason always stands in need of being purified by faith. And for its part, religion always needs to be purified by reason in order to show its authentically human face. So he saw them as being both essential and playing off each other. You know, so like if you're just so much into just reason and you lose sight of faith, then it's gonna be.
Wasn't he the one who came up with the term intelligent? Or intelligent design, or what was that term?
I don't know that was that. I don't remember that as coming from him. Maybe I know what you're talking about,
but I can't remember something to do with the idea that the creator,
in terms of evolution and all that. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure what he said about that. But he definitely, you know, evolution. If that's how it worked, you know, then that would be fight that. He said, "Faith and religion and faith can come to each other's assistance. Only together will they save man. Entranced by an exclusive reliance on technology, reason without faith is doomed to flounder in an illusion of its own omnipotence. Faith without reason risks being cut off from everyday life." So they need each other. Is what he's saying. One or the other, you're going to go off in a bad direction, and it's going to be problematic.
So, where did you see an interconnection between his theology and his spirituality?
So he would say, you know, if the Eucharist is the source and summit, you know, and everything about Christian life, and so liturgy and all that. So he would, I think, start with liturgy, and he said right praise, worship, liturgy, leads to right doctrine. Right doctrine, the fancy word for that is orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. So he would start with, like I said, liturgy is always kind of the center of things for him. Mm-hmm. Liturgy leads to right doctrine. The intellectual theologian kind of a thing. It's going back to the intellectual and that we started out with and
pastorally, intellectually, and spiritually.
And spiritual, right. So starting out with the spiritual, you know, right praise leads to right doctrine, the intellectual orthodoxy, which leads than to right action or practice, orthopraxy, so pastoral care. So that's right action or right practice, is the word is orthopraxy. Mm-hmm. So, which is, you know, pastoral care for the poor, the sick, the abandoned. So that's how those all fit together.
Comes first, or do they all kind of?
I was saying praise. Yeah. Liturgy is the source and summit of our Christian life, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Eucharist.
It starts with prayer.
Starts with prayer, and that's why that was so center for him.
Okay.
The liturgy. And then that leads to, if that's in good order, and like right, mm-hmm. there's right praise, then it leads to, you know, a correct doctrine.
Okay.
And then if we have good doctrine, then that leads to good actions, the right action, orthopraxy.
Led by the Holy Spirit, I guess.
Through the all. Prayer. Right, exactly. Right.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So then Catholics had high praise for his apostolic exhortation, Sacramentum Caritatis, the sacrament of charity. What was striking to you about that document, about that exhortation?
Well, I mean, you know, the first sentence is always important in these documents, papal documents, and the title comes from that. The sacrament of charity is the first, you know, first mm-hmm. words, and that's how, you know, then Sacramentum Caritatis. So the first sentence is the sacrament of charity. The Holy Eucharist is the gift that Jesus Christ makes of himself, thus revealing us to us God's infinite love for every man and woman. Right, so again, you know, it's the same kinds of things we've been saying. There's mm-hmm. there's liturgy, there's the Eucharist, and then it leads, that reveals God's love. He always was hitting on love. And so, and he says, you know, he said in there, the gospel story of the life, death, and new life of Jesus vividly displays the height, breadth, length and depth of the love of Jesus. So, you know, just taking a look at the story of Jesus, that helps us understand how much he loves us, right?
Right.
And he's, you know, another thing I like from there, in terms of what was striking in that document, the liturgy of the word prepares the table for the liturgy of the Eucharist. So we know it's that order, the word first, and then we hear, and then we celebrate the Eucharist. But that, this is kind of nice in terms of preparing the table.
I like that.
For the Lord's Eucharist.
He said, and then it prepares you for the work outside.
Right, yeah, right, yeah, right. And then he says, you know, scripture and sacrament, story and supper mutually illumine each other, which is nice.
That's nice. That's nice language.
You know, and then since we're in the whole thing, Eucharistic revival, I quote this a lot from this document. He wrote that the Eucharist is a mystery to be believed, celebrated, and lived.
Yes.
You know, and again, it's believe, then there's intellectual thing, celebrated, there's a liturgical thing, lived is a pastoral thing. Again, it gets kind of pulling those things together.
Right. I included something from that document in an editorial.
Oh, good.
It was very inspiring. But
yeah.
So what were the most significant challenges that he dealt with during his papacy, would you say?
I would say that, you know, there's anybody that's in that office for any period of time, there's going to be a number of things that are going to be challenges. But the two most important ones, I think, were sexual abuse and finances. And when he was elected, you know, it's like, deal with these things. And they said the same thing with Pope Francis to a certain extent,
yeah.
You know. And so I think Benedict kind of grabbed onto those and got as far as he was going to be able to get with them,
right.
You know, and then he handed it off. But starting with finances, there's corruption in the Vatican, that area of finance. And so he worked at that. He took some steps with it, but he had difficulty with it, and anybody would have. So he got, like I said, as far as he could with it. But then, you know, with regard to clergy sexual abuse, he was, and some people would say he didn't do enough, and okay. But he was the first person in the Vatican as a prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith to take clergy sex abuse that crisis seriously and to begin to do something about it. I mean, I think everybody would agree with that. He laicized hundreds of priests, maybe almost 1,000. And then as Pope, he moved much more decisively, I would suggest, than Pope John Paul II, to respond to this crisis. I mean, we're kind of getting a sense more and more of how serious it was and is. And he welcomed the American bishops' zero tolerance policy enacted in 2002. Some people they thought that was going too far. He welcomed, and then it ultimately became sort of the standard for the whole church. But there was also a widespread perception that the Vatican's approach to the sexual abuse crisis seemed more concerned with the church's reputation than with the well-being of survivors. Yeah. So some people would criticize kind of some of the decisions that he made in that area. So there is, those are the two main things. But there's also, you know, there's an occasional public gaffe, you know,
right.
And there are for Francis, Pope Francis too. Like the one that you hear about, people remember the most is, it was well-intentioned, but, it was this well-intentioned but ill-received address in Regensburg, you know, which angered a lot of Muslims and kind of hampered the church's interfaith efforts. When he quoted a Byzantine emperor who linked Muhammad with violence, and it didn't come across the way he wanted it to come across, but so it goes. Yeah.
So my last question then, and I don't know, this maybe is a repeat, but what the heck. What is your lasting impression of Pope Emeritus?
So I was just, you know, I was thinking about that. I'm just going to quote some of his own words again.
Okay.
Because a couple of these lines maybe I've quoted already, but this, you know, this says to me, it says a lot to me about him, these things. Like I said already, when he was elected Pope, Pope Benedict described himself as a simple, humble laborer in the vineyard of the Lord. I like that, you know. He also said to those gathered in St. Peter's Square, do not be afraid of Christ. He takes nothing away and he gives you everything. I've always liked that. Don't be afraid of him. Like, oh my God, Jesus. But no, he takes nothing away what do I have to give up? Nothing, you know, and he'll give you everything. The homily at the Mass for his inauguration, he said, the church is alive, and she is alive because Christ is alive, because he is truly risen. Something nice about that, you know, just that, the way he put it. I said this already, love seeks understanding. It wishes to know even better the one whom it loves. It seeks his face. Another line, I was reading some of these things when I was reading things about people were saying about him. I'd forgotten some of these things, but they came back to mind. So he said once, life is not a circle that closes, but a line that tends toward its fullness. That's kind of nice, you know.
Interesting.
And then his final words on his deathbed were, you know, Jesus, I love you. Jesus, ich liebe dich. German, Jesus, I love you. That's how he closed it out, speaking of love, of course.
Awesome.
Which is very beautiful.
That seems like a great way to end our podcast
today.
Yeah,
I think so.
Thanks, Bishop.
Yep.
See you next time.
Sure, you bet.